It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're coming in with a little happiness from Pharrell Williams today to celebrate the International Day of Happiness. And you can tell us what makes you happy or post a picture of something that makes you happy on the Central Time Facebook page.
It's March 20th, which makes it the second annual International Day of Happiness. The United Nations General Assembly pegged today as a time for the world community to think about the relevance of happiness and well-being to people around the globe and to encourage nations to pursue happiness in their public policy objectives.
Joining us now to talk about the International Day of Happiness is Lisa Napoli. She's an arts reporter for KCRW in Los Angeles and the author of Radio Shangri-La, What I Discovered on My Accidental Journey to the Happiest Kingdom on Earth. Lisa, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Let's start with the International Day of Happiness. Why does the UN think we need it?
Well, it's so loaded, the word happiness. But basically, the United Nations is looking at rejiggering how we consider happiness. Happiness isn't about stuff. It's not necessarily about having lots and lots of money. They're encouraging people to look at the idea that the gross domestic product, this land grab for money and stuff, is not really what we need to be happy, what's best for our well-being. So it's about getting people to step back and pause and think differently about what happiness is.
Are there consistent measures of what makes people happy across cultures and nations, or is it different in every country?
Well, basically, the bottom line, if you look at happiness economics, which is a growing field over the last 15 years or so, basically, the bottom line is if you have a roof over your head, if you have enough food to eat, if you have family and love and access to things like education and health care and clean drinking water for the people in your family, that's what the benchmark is for happiness. All the studies show that you don't have to be rich to be happy. It does, of course, help to have the basics in life. But what is basic to you in one country might be different than what's basic to somebody in Bangladesh, of course. But the bottom line is that. And the reason you're talking to me is the book I wrote, Radio Shangri-La, is about a little country that for many years was considered to be the quote-unquote happiest kingdom on earth, because Bhutan, which is a tiny country in the Himalayas, is in fact, by typical metrics of finances, very poor, but was found to be a very happy place for quite a long time. Part of that has to do with the fact that Bhutan didn't have television until 1999, so there wasn't a big consumer influx telling people there what they didn't have, which of course doesn't make you very happy.
Part of the goal here, it sounds like, is to make this a public policy priority. But how can a nation, a government, change their laws to encourage happiness?
Well, that's the tricky part. You know, of course, when you say it like that, of course, that's impossible to legislate.
I mandate happiness.
Right. You must be happy. You will be happy. Otherwise, you can't live here.
Or you will be punished.
Or you will be punished. But I happen to be talking to you from Santa Monica, which is right now looking at different ways of encouraging well-being in the community, in the sense that, of course, we're famous here in Los Angeles area for terrible traffic and long commutes. All of us as a nation are not so great much of the time about health and fitness and eating well. So governments all around the world are following the Bhutan lead, the gross national happiness index that they've created, and looking at ways to tweak and make better, more available things that make life better. For instance, cutting down commutes, encouraging people to eat more healthfully, to exercise, to spend more time with each other. And of course, all of those things are super complicated, right? Because, you know, yes, we can all say, as we know well, everybody should have health care. It doesn't quite work that way. But the idea that the UN is leading this movement to get people to think differently about happiness, that it isn't just money, 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 work, 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 but spending time with your family, being able to enjoy the outdoors, preserving nature, those are issues that come up time and again in any community around the world. And not to simplify it, because it isn't simple, but it is also very important to, as every study shows, to our well-being, being with each other, spending time with each other, eating healthfully, eating slowly, deliberately, not rushing.
Is there any evidence that happier countries are also maybe more successful countries?
Well, you have, places like Denmark and the Netherlands. The Scandinavian countries are just high marks in every sense, in the way that the people are treated, the way the people, actually, I shouldn't say that, because there are all kinds of bad things going on right now in the Netherlands, racist movements and all of that. But the government policies there are to support education and to support healthcare. Of course, those places are wealthier places than places like the Kingdom of Bhutan in terms of sheer economics. But the problem with this whole dialogue, and it's a great thing that we're having it, is that it's really hard to just say wholesale that one place is better than another. Anybody in any of those other places in the Scandinavian countries, there are issues everywhere. But countries that do commit to gross national happiness ideals over gross domestic product do show that people are generally, and this is hugely generalizing, but generally better off, happier day to day. And again, happy is not skipping down the street smiling. It's wellness. It's the internal wellness that's what's most important.
Well, you mentioned the time you spent in Bhutan. Did it feel like a happy place? Did the people seem content or however observably happy?
Well, what's so interesting is that in many ways, people there did seem like they were happier. But part of it is that here in this country, we don't always take time to talk to each other about whether we're doing well or how we're feeling. That community, that sense of community that we all crave and that we sometimes overlook is still existent in a place like Bhutan, because it is a smaller place. It is a place that's more connected in terms of the old-fashioned connectivity. That, of course, is changing rapidly as technology comes in. People, all you need to do is go on my Facebook page, look me up, Lisa Napoli on Facebook, and you'll see a lot of young Bhutanese people there who are angsting over various issues. But it is a happier place in the sense that the government there is committed to the well-being of its people in the sense of the nature and in the sense of making life more comfortable. That said, there are issues in Bhutan, as there are around the world, where people are excluded. People of certain races and religions are excluded. So it is very, very complicated. But I did find myself personally while I was in Bhutan how much happier I felt being in a place where the speed was slowed down.
Bhutan is an example of a country that is moving slowly into the technological age. I imagine it has less material resources in general, including economics, money, than a place like Denmark. But do you think that the politics enters into this? Is happiness a political thing? You mentioned the Scandinavian countries, and they tend to usually, I think, score pretty high in terms of the happiness factor of their citizens. And they are also countries that have pretty significant social safety nets.
Right. And they are also places that don't necessarily have a huge governmentally kind of orchestrated commitment to religion, for lack of a better way of putting it, whereas Bhutan is a deeply religious, largely Buddhist country, where they've been trying to institute, or they have been instituting, meditation in the mornings at school as a way to get people to sort of reset and recalibrate. And even there, that was a complex and not always easy to to sell kind of thing. So it's a complicated thing. Yes, a richer country is going to have a different take on it than a poorer country. Bhutan's government is, their hallmark is this, pretty much by accident, because gross national happiness was just a phrase uttered by the fourth king years and years ago that has taken on a life of its own. It's a pithy, ironically, marketing slogan in many ways, or it's become that, when in fact the essence of gross national happiness is anti-marketing. Don't let consumeristic values govern your happiness, your well-being, how you live your life. Allow what's inward to guide you. And that's why, again, many of the happiness economics metrics and people who study this say the people who are of faith, whatever that faith is, are often happier than people who aren't, because they're not letting external forces govern what they do, how they behave.
Lisa, thank you so much for joining us, and happy International Day of Happiness.
Happy Happiness Day to you, too. Thank you so much for asking me to talk about it.
Yeah. Lisa Napoli.
And happy spring.
Yes, that, too, happens in Wisconsin. We're ready for that. Well, we've been talking to Lisa Napoli, an arts reporter for KCRW in Los Angeles and the author of Radio Shangri-La.
First, we continue our coverage of the ongoing situation in Ukraine. President Obama announced further sanctions against Russia this morning in response to the country's move to annex Ukraine's Crimea region.
But our next guest, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, wants the United States to go further and send military aid to Ukraine to maintain its border integrity and defend itself from further invasion.
Senator Johnson, welcome to the show.
Well, guys, how you doing?
Good. Well, let's start with some background. As a member of the Senate's Foreign Relations Committee, you were in Kiev recently. You met with Ukrainian government officials, protest leaders, and others. What did you learn from talking with the various groups there?
Well, first of all, it was a pretty sobering experience, as you're meeting with the individuals you talked about, the prime minister, the acting president, pretty sober individuals, understanding that Vladimir Putin's goal, his eventual goal, wasn't just Crimea. It really was, in their words, Kiev. In other words, all of Ukraine and probably beyond that. Vladimir Putin has announced that, from his standpoint, the greatest geopolitical catastrophe was the breakup of the Soviet Union in the last century. And his aim is to reconstitute the Soviet Union. So nobody wants to return to the Cold War, but we have to recognize the reality that certainly the aggressive action that Vladimir Putin has taken sure has Cold War overturns or overtones to it. And we need to recognize that reality and not only talk tough, but we actually have to take some pretty firm measures. We have to demonstrate some real strength and resolve if we're going to deter Vladimir Putin from going further.
Well, Putin has said, I know there have been mixed messages, he has said, at least in one instance, nope, we're not interested in eastern Ukraine. You don't buy that?
He said that about Crimea. So, no, you cannot believe Vladimir Putin. It's foolish to believe a word that he said. He's former head of the KGB. He has absolutely got his mind set on reconstituting the Soviet Union, and he will take advantage of the West's weakness. He will take advantage of any opportunity to expand his influence and power. And we ignore that reality at our own peril.
As we mentioned, you, after this trip, said the United States should send some form of military aid to Ukraine. What do you have in mind?
Well, we should support the courageous action of the Ukrainian people. When Prime Minister Yatsenyuk was here in Washington, he asked pretty modest a request to provide his hollowed-out military. Now, they've got over 100,000 people in the military, but only 6,000 were combat-ready. And so they had a relatively simple request for some small arms and ammunition to give them some ability to defend themselves, which, when we were there, the government officials were dedicated to defending Ukrainian territory. And, of course, because of the Budapest Memorandum, we are somewhat obliged to help them do just that. And so it was a pretty modest request. Regrettably, President Obama turned him down. What I suggested, maybe if we're not willing to provide them some small arms and ammunition, maybe we could at least send a military mission, not combat troops, but military experts to assess what Ukraine might need in terms of the short term to strengthen their military capabilities and also their long term. I think that would send a pretty strong signal to Vladimir Putin that we are going to help Ukraine defend its border integrity and, quite honestly, honor our commitments to NATO in terms of Lithuania and Latvia and Estonia as well.
Are you worried that there'd be a risk of this further escalating the crisis if there's any kind of military aid from the West there?
I'm concerned across the board. I mean, this is a very dangerous situation, but I believe it's riskier to allow Vladimir Putin to undertake this aggressive expansion with impunity. He never paid a price for his expansion into Georgia, and as a result, that emboldened him. And he'll strike when there's a moment of weakness, where there's a moment of opportunity. And if we don't show our willingness to act, if we don't show resolve, he'll continue this expansionary policy. And that's very destabilizing for the world, very destabilizing. So in the end, it is in the United States' best interest to make sure that we deter further aggression on the part of Vladimir Putin.
From an everyday American perspective, this is on the other side of the world. Ukraine is not a NATO ally. We're not under direct treaty obligation. Why should Americans be worried enough to want the United States to take some kind of action here?
Because we live in a global economy, and this level of instability is not good for our national security. It's not good for the global economy. If this continues, it's just a matter of time before NATO countries are threatened. And then you're talking about a much higher level commitment on part of the U.S. But again, remember, in exchange for giving up their nuclear weapons, Ukraine was given assurances that its border integrity would be maintained. Now, that's obviously gone out the window with one of the signatories of that memorandum. Russia has now invaded illegally Crimea. And so future countries that are considering giving up their nuclear capabilities or being deterred from acquiring a new nuclear capability will take a look at what is happening in Ukraine and come to their own conclusions, which is not good if you're interested in nuclear nonproliferation. So again, this has serious complications or consequences long term, and so we better do everything we can to honor those commitments we made to Ukraine when they gave up their nuclear weapons.
President Obama has announced some more economic sanctions today, targeting supporters of Putin, wealthy people in Putin's circle and in government leadership. Do you think that will be at all effective?
Well, the initial sanctions were so weak that they were mocked by the people they were targeting. They laughed at them, which isn't a good sign when you're trying to make them pay a price and they're laughing at you. I haven't been able to analyze exactly what's been done. We should be strengthening economic sanctions. By the way, that is a battle that Putin is sure to lose. In looking at the Ukraine, you have to really analyze the situation in terms of, why does Vladimir Putin have the strength? Why does he have the confidence to do this? Well, he's primarily strong because of their oil and gas resources and the fact that Ukraine and Europe is dependent on those oil resources. So we need to weaken that power that Vladimir Putin has. We should open up world energy markets. We should certainly be willing to export our growing oil and gas resources. That would certainly weaken Vladimir Putin. The other thing that makes him strong is our own economic and international weakness that we've been demonstrating. We need to show greater strength, greater resolve. That also would weaken his hand.
Do you see any scenario where the United States would actually have military intervention of some sort, boots on the ground or air intervention, maybe a no-flight zone, anything like that in Ukraine, Crimea, or the area?
That is something that I think the Ukrainian government was requesting when we were there is a possibility. I think no-fly zones actually could be something that we can consider. It would send a pretty strong signal. We are doing offering and participating in air patrols in the Baltic states, Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia. And I think that can actually be pretty effective. So that could be one of those strong signals I think maybe the U.S. government should consider. I don't see combat boots on the ground at all, no.
A Putin appointee to the state-run media was reported as saying something to the effect of, United States, remember, we're the only country in the world that still has the nuclear capacity to reduce you to ashes. I'm paraphrasing a bit there. Do you worry about escalation to some kind of nuclear conflict?
I do worry about it, but I also pointed out when I was in Ukraine that there is one man that has escalated the situation. There's one man that if further blood is shed in Ukraine, that we need to hold responsible and hold accountable. And that's Vladimir Putin. This is really the action of one man that is destabilizing the region and that threatens greater escalation. It's not the United States, but the way we need to deter this, the only way we can expect de-escalation of the situation is to show the type of strength and resolve that we're currently not showing. In other words, peace through strength actually works. By showing weakness, you will increase the chances of the situation actually escalating and not de-escalating.
We're talking with U.S. Senator Ron Johnson about why he thinks the United States should send military aid to Ukraine. He stays with us after the news, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What would you like to see from the United States in regard to what's going on in Ukraine, Crimea, and Russia? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Senator Ron Johnson about the situation in Ukraine. He says we should send military aid to the country, help arm the Ukrainian army so they can have their full force available in case of, well, a worst-case scenario. What do you think? We're taking your questions and your comments at 800-642-1234. What's the right United States response? What Senator Johnson is saying? More economic sanctions? Nothing? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now, Senator Johnson. We've got Art on the line in Milwaukee. Art, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Senator. I don't know if you're aware of the fact that the first George Bush, who had been the head of the CIA, by the way, assured the Soviet Union that if they dissolved the Warsaw Pact, that NATO would not move into former Warsaw Pact areas. And now I hear you saying that maybe we should have a no-fly zone over the Ukraine, which is, you know, right up to Russia and was the center of the Soviet Union. And so that promise was breached. And to say that there's one man, one man only, responsible for this, when you're talking about militarizing in the heart of a very powerful country that's very far away, I think it's very risky and not consistent with the traditional Republican views of trying to save money and protect our own interests.
Art, thanks for the call. Senator Johnson?
Well, Art, you know, appreciate the question and comment. But again, we did sign the Budapest Memorandum in 1994 that basically assured that Ukraine, for giving up its nuclear weapons, which was a pretty dangerous situation, that we collectively, with Russia, with England, I believe France also signed that, but certainly the U.S. did, we said we would assure their border integrity. And now, of course, one of the signatories of that memorandum, Russia, has blatantly and illegally invaded Crimea. And now it looks like they're bent on annexing it. And so we have to have a response to that. I'm not talking about militarizing or putting our combat boots on the ground, but if requested by Ukraine to offer some minimal assistance, to provide some assurance and provide some pushback to Vladimir Putin, I think that's something we should consider. So it's all in context of exactly what is happening at the time and exactly what the government and the courage of the Ukrainian people, what that kind of dictates. I mean, these are some freedom-seeking people that protested for a corrupt-free democracy, which is, they've had a real problem there. And with the type of pressure that Russia has been providing or putting on those fledgling democracies, I just think, you know, as fellow freedom-seeking people, we ought to provide that level of support.
The Russian government, Putin, have been saying, hey, there was a referendum in Crimea, overwhelming support for secession from Ukraine joining Russia. You don't buy that as an argument?
Well, first of all, it was a referendum that was implemented at the point of a gun. The only thing transparent was the ballot box that under Russian observers, people knew exactly how they're going to vote. Listen, I don't deny the fact that Crimea, the 2,000 people that populate Crimea, are many of them are Russian leaning. But if that would have been a truly democratic result based on the Ukrainian constitution, where all Ukrainians would have, you know, had to decide that, it might have been a different result. But that's the way that process should have been played out, not under the type of illegal pressure that Russia brought into that process. It was just an utterly illegitimate process, which I think the UN, when they voted, was, I believe it was 13-1 with China abstaining and Russia being the only no vote. I think that pretty well showed the world's opinion of what that referendum was. So that, in no way, shape, or form does that show a legitimate result.
What are you hearing from your Senate colleagues since you got back from Ukraine and called for answering Ukraine's request for military aid?
Well, first of all, I believe the bipartisan Senate delegation that went over there, there are three Democrats led by Senator Dick Durbin, and our delegation was led by Senator John McCain. I think we were all moved, all sobered by the experience, and we want to be as united as possible in our support for the Ukrainian people. Now, we may have some minor differences. Again, I'm not talking about massive amounts of aid here. I'm just talking about a pretty modest level of support requested by the Ukrainian prime minister to help arm their hollowed-out military that was hollowed out by Yanukovych, who was pretty much what it appears to be is Vladimir Putin's puppet in Ukraine.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Dale on the line in Nina. Dale, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Well, Dale,
I'd like to know how, since we're already trillions of dollars in debt as a country, I'd like to know how you can afford to do it. I'd love to help everybody in the world with all of their problems, but we can't.
I understand, but what I don't want to be is penny wise and pound foolish. And I think the cost of not showing strength and resolve, not coming to help, defend a country like Ukraine could be far more costly in the future if this thing actually does escalate. And again, I think the best way to prevent further escalation, further expansionary aggression by Putin would be to show a minimal level of support. Again, we're just talking about all I was doing is responding to what the Prime Minister of Ukraine was requesting was small arms and some ammunition to provide some level of support for really the courage of the Ukrainian people.
We'll be watching this Ukraine issue. I'm sure you will, too. While we've got you here, I'd like to ask a couple questions, if I may, closer to home. Some news this week. The Department of Justice asked a judge to dismiss a lawsuit you filed over coverage of congressional staffers through the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, saying that personal offense or indignation is not a legal basis to sue. So no basis to sue there. What do you make of that? Well, how do you respond to that?
Well, obviously, my legal team has a different opinion of my ability to obtain standing. And I thought it was interesting that the administration's response was primarily on the standing issue. They just wanted to just dismiss it. They have a very difficult time arguing the merits of my case because their executive order through Office of Personnel Management was a very political one. It's kind of hard for them to defend that special treatment for members of Congress. I really do think that we need to adhere to the principle of equal treatment under the law, and that's what they're unable to defend. So it was fully expected on our part. We'll respond on April 7th and hope that the judge will allow us to actually try our case on its merit in front of the court.
And then finally, your colleagues seem more and more optimistic that Republicans will have a good shot at taking control of the Senate in November. We don't have a say in that here in Wisconsin. No Senate elections here. What do you make of your chances, your party's chances at controlling the Senate next year?
Well, I think because the American people are seeing and feeling and experiencing, unfortunately, the real damage that's being done by the health care law and the fact that the Senate Majority Leader, goes to the floor of the Senate and in a very highly political manner, basically called certainly Wisconsinites that are feeling that pain and they're writing into us a bunch of liars. I mean, that's pretty outrageous, and I think it does certainly increase our chances to gain a majority in the Senate. But, I actually want to win a majority. I don't want to take the majority by the other side just losing. I think we need to show the American people what we're for, which is why I filed a bill called If You Like Your Health Plan, You Can Keep It Act. That'd be a true grandfather clause, and why I'm working with colleagues in the House to have a piece of legislation. I'd like to title it Preserving Freedom and Choice in Healthcare that would actually repair the damage that's been done by Obamacare, try and limit and prevent future damage. So I think the American people deserve to be shown what we're for, and that's what I'm working hard to do.
Senator Johnson, thanks for joining us today.
Have a great day.
That's U.S. Senator Ron Johnson.
As the world of medicine continues to pave the way toward non-invasive treatments for various ailments, our next guest has been called a pioneer in the field of light therapy. Early research suggests that using certain wavelengths of light can clear infections and treat certain autoimmune and chronic diseases.
Chukwuka Enwemeka is dean of UW-Milwaukee's College of Health Sciences. He'll be giving a talk presented by the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters next Tuesday night at 7. It's called Full Spectrum, The Promise of Light as Medicine. Chukwuka, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So I've heard of light in treatment of seasonal affective disorder, but this goes way beyond that. Can you explain what phototherapy is, please?
That's correct. Phototherapy, in this sense, is the use of different colors of light, call it wavelengths of light, to treat a variety of diseases and conditions. To give you an example, we are using this now to treat pain, particularly pain of head and neck origin, pain due to carpal tunnel syndrome, low back pain, and pain due to certain diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis and osteoarthritis, as well as to heal the body when the body is injured and cannot heal itself, for example, with chronic wounds and with ulcers and so on.
Well, let's get into the wound and infection side of things first. What kind of light are we talking about that might be helpful?
Here we're talking about near-infrared light and red light. Near-infrared light, for the benefit of listeners, light in the that is invisible but very close to the red spectrum of the wavelength. Hence, it is called infrared, which means below red. In terms of the wavelength. The wavelength is actually above red, but the first time it was discovered, it was thought to be below red.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what's the science there? How would that infrared light just off to the red side of the spectrum help with something like an infection?
We are yet to fully understand the entire mechanisms that are involved, but for now, the theory that is being pursued and which seems to be gaining a lot of prominence is the fact that these wavelengths of light are absorbed by certain chemicals in the cells of the body known as chromophores collectively, in particular one of them which is called cytochrome C oxidase, found in the mitochondria, inner membrane of the mitochondria, appears to be really sensitive to these wavelengths of light. And the light energy that is absorbed here begins to modulate the action of this molecule, the cytochrome C oxidase, and then causes the cytochrome C oxidase to influence electron transfer mechanism of mitochondria, resulting in the synthesis of large amounts of ATP, which, as you know, is the form of energy that the cells use for repair, for growth, for everything that they do. So once the extra boost of energy is available to the cell, now the cell is capable of fighting diseases and healing the body, synthesizing some of the enzymes and proteins that are needed to effect healing.
So if I'm a patient here and I guess I have a wound or something with a stubborn infection, what would my treatment be like if I were in the, I think this is still experimental, but what would I go through to get this infrared light therapy?
You're right. It's still experimental. And what will happen is that typically the wound will be cleaned up and then some chemical applied and then the wound is dressed up again and then the patient goes home. But with light therapy, what happens is that the wound is cleaned up and before redressing the wound and all that, this infrared light is then shone on the wound for up to 2, 3, 4 minutes, sometimes depending on the power and the output of the device that is being used. The treatment could be as long as 5 minutes, 10 minutes, and then the wound is then dressed up again and then the patient is sent home. In the experimental work we did in Brazil, we took patients with diabetic ulcers that were not responding to any known treatment. And I mean any known treatment. They had tried everything that was available, and the patients were not responding. and we treated them in this fashion, two times per week, and each treatment was just 3 minutes of light plus dressing up and then making sure that the wound bed was cleaned in the normal fashion. And within a period of 12 weeks total, all these wounds had healed. 75% of them had healed fully, and those that were not fully healed had actually healed almost completely, that the patients were then allowed to stay on the study for a longer period of time, and then they were all fully healed. The interesting thing about this study in Brazil that we did and published in 2009 is that the patients have not since, none of them has since returned with any wound. And these are people that have had diabetic ulcers for a very, very long period of time.
So this is, if these experimental results hold up, this is exciting news for people with diabetes, for whom a wound, especially at an extremity in their feet, can be deadly in some cases.
This is correct. As you know, those wounds in the lower extremities often get worse and then progress to a point where it becomes gangrenous, and sometimes the limb is then amputated, which is the ultimate outcome of this sometimes. And so having this type of treatment that could stop the wound from getting worse and, in fact, heal the wound means that we can prevent some of those amputations and other complications of diabetes.
So we've been spending all our time so far on one end of the color chart, the Roy G. Biv. We've been in infrared territory. Your work, though, has been on the opposite end, on the blue side of things, ultraviolet. How does blue light therapy work?
Yes. Since 2007, we have focused our attention on the use of blue light. Very close to ultraviolet, not really ultraviolet itself, but blue light in the range of 405 to 470 nanometers for those listeners who are scientifically inclined. and what we're finding is that this wavelength kills bacteria and kills the deadly bug that everybody seems to be afraid of today, the methicillin-resistant strain of Staphylococcus aureus.
That's MRSA, right?
MRSA or MRSA, yeah. And we, in one shot, were able to kill as much as 92% of the bacteria colonies in vitro. And we have repeated these experiments over and over again, and the results are the same. Both 405 nanometer wavelength and 470 nanometer wavelength were equally effective in doing this. And we found that when we repeated the experiment and now did multiple treatments, so you do like two or three treatments, we were able to wipe out the entire 100% in vitro. So we are at a point where we are now trying to design experiments that will result in the use of even very smaller amounts of light that we know will be absolutely safe to use in clinical practice. And we're doing that by designing some tools that would be that could be used by clinicians.
So it's destroying the MRSA in vitro. That, if I'm not super scientific, that means in a petri dish, more or less, not on a human.
Not on a human. That's correct. In a petri dish, and the implications are quite significant, because it would mean that it could be wiped out from surfaces and from the environment, you know, using these dosages.
So the big concern is in a hospital, on the surfaces, on a hospital bed, on sheets, on walls, on sinks, that's where the MRSA bacteria are being spread. So if you could treat them with this light, you wouldn't even need to direct the light directly on a patient.
That's correct. Plus, I think it is also important to point out that there are really two, there are so many strains of the bacteria. There are two that are very common in this country. There are other strains that are common in other countries. We have two major strains here. One is hospital-acquired strain, the HA MRSA, and the other is the community-acquired strain of MRSA, which is known as the CA MRSA. The community-acquired strain is more ubiquitous and is found in locker rooms, on the beaches, in places where people congregate, on the playing field, athletic playing fields, and so on and so forth. that has turned out to become the to raise concern of everybody. And so having this type of tool that can wipe out the bacteria from surfaces will be very effective for stemming the tide of community-acquired MRSA.
So are
and
we,
also hospital-acquired MRSA.
Are you putting this, or are people trying to put this to the test experimentally in hospital rooms and maybe in locker rooms?
We are working on some of that, yes.
Is this also something, the infrared ones you talked about were something that, you know, you would shine directly on me if I were a patient with certain conditions. Is this the ultraviolet something that you might shine directly on a patient affected by MRSA?
Yeah, we are actually staying away from ultraviolet light because, as you know, UV can be damaging and has really some detrimental effects on the human body. And they're very difficult to use because even the slightest amount of overdose can cause real problems for people. This is one of the reasons that we are exploring this blue light technology. Because blue light is safe. It's clearly safe. We receive doses of blue light from the sun every day, and it doesn't seem to have much of any harmful effect on us. So we're staying away from that. And the infrared, obviously, is also very safe. You and I are biggest sources of infrared radiation, believe it or not. So you radiate infrared, every human being radiates infrared, you know, and every, you know, creature radiates infrared, which is one of the reasons it is so easy for people that use night vision goggles to see things at night. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just very briefly, if this checks out experimentally, this sounds like a cheap treatment for a lot of things.
That is correct. And you know, the biggest thing about the work we are doing with blue light is that we are using commonly available light-emitting diodes in this regard. Commonly available light-emitting diodes that are very, very cheap. Not lasers, not, you know, high-technology photodynamic therapy and things like that. So this will make for the development of an effective treatment that is really very totally inexpensive and could be ubiquitously used.
Well, we'll watch for the results of your future research. Chukwuka, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Chukwuka Enwemeka, Dean of UW-Milwaukee's College of Health Sciences. He's speaking at the Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery in Madison next Tuesday night at 7. We've got some info on the Central Time Facebook page.